Hi, everybody. This is Robert Spiewak, host of 24 Flames Per Second, coming at you with a content warning for this episode, of course, to kick off Horror Month. It follows. We have mentions of sexual assault in this episode because there are some of those things in the movie. And so everybody, just fair warning that that comes up in conversation a couple times. And so, yeah, everybody, for those that continue listening to the episode, we hope you enjoy it. And if you don't, that's just fine, too. Thanks, everybody. Let's get on with the show. On this week's episode, we run away and it follows. Can kids handle their shit? What would it shapeshift into to get close to you? And is this a feature-length STD commercial? Find out now. You're listening to 24 Flames Per Second. All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of 24 Flames Per Second. And it's not just another episode. It's the beginning of Horror Month, everybody. Welcome to our favorite month on the show. October 2020, maybe the scariest October we've ever had. And welcome, everybody. As always, I'm your host, Robert Spiewak. And this is the podcast that roasts the films we love the most. And we're talking about, to kick off Horror Month, in kind of a weird allegorical sense, where Horror Month will follow this episode, we're talking about It Follows. And the It is the rest of the show and the rest of the month. Horror Month, It Follows. You get it? Okay, great. We're moving on. And yeah, everybody, we're excited to talk about this one. Got a good panel put together. And here at the beginning of October, we've got a new drink along, probably, hopefully, over on our Patreon. We kind of have a bonus one, if I'm going to be honest with you, because we took down our Mulan drink along because fuck that movie, actually. And we're doing the live action one, not the animated one, necessarily, I guess. Go listen to our Mulan episode from March. but yeah, so we're replacing that with The Babysitter, and so that's up there. And then if everything goes according to plan, there will be a new one for October up there. May or may not be from our 24-hour horror marathon. We don't know how we're doing that yet when we're recording this, but that's okay. And so everybody, head to patreon.com/24flamespod to get all that good stuff, and our extended plays and our hot takes. It's a big bag of fun. And so, yeah, everybody, excited to get into this episode this week. And we're talking about It Follows. And I'm going to start with the person walking over there to my person walking over here, Casey Rom.
Hello.
How's it going?
It's good. I recently got internet shopping scammed.
Oh, no.
And so that's kind of my horror right now, is that
the hackers are following you.
Well, it was more of a, like, you purchase something and then what shows up is not at all that item. And yeah, and then they make it, like, virtually impossible to return it or open any kind of claim, because they're like, if you return it, we'll give you your money back. And it's like, I'm not going to ship this piece of shit back to China. So,
yeah.
No.
Well, I'm sorry that happened to you.
Yeah. I mean, that's like the pandemic horror, right? Like online shopping mishap.
Yeah, I guess. On to other news. Did you watch the movie this week?
I didn't. I love this movie, but I think that it's a difficult watch, and I was not in the right headspace for it. But I did listen to a podcast that I already listened to it, but there was an episode about this movie. It's called The Horror Virgin, and it's like two horror loving friends watch movies with their friend who hates horror.
Nice.
And so listening to them talk about it, like, gave me enough of a refresher without having to, like, go through it.
Okay, well, what do you know about it?
So I think that the thing that most people find that sticks out about this movie is that it is intentionally a little obscure as to where it's taking place, what time of year it's taking place, what year is it taking place. And it's purposely, you know, obscured a little bit by the types of outfits you'll see the characters wearing, everything from like bathing suits to coats. You see, you know, really old cars, really new cars. A piece of technology that I think is like the main takeaway that people have from this movie, which is the shell phone. That's my personal finish your drink when you watch this movie, is when the shell phone makes its debut. Oh, so I think that that was a choice that the director slash writer found really important. And I'm sure we're going to hear from both sides of the panel about whether that was the right choice.
Right.
And then the other thing that I just wanted to mention, and, you know, maybe there needs to be a content warning at the top of this episode, but the nature of the film is, you know, often compared to the idea of like a sexually transmitted disease.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the people who watched this movie took away more of a sexual assault kind of undercurrent to it, and that was something that I hadn't really noticed on my first watch but seemed super obvious on my second watch. So
yeah,
it's definitely difficult. You know, there's a scene where someone is chloroformed in her underwear, and I think that's not to be taken lightly. So
totally
protect yourself if you're gonna watch this one.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you for all that. The background, the context, that's good stuff as we go into the rest of the show. And so let's get on with the rest of the panels this week. We'll start with the roasters. First up, actor and designer. You can find him on social media at A K A Day. Kwesi Phillips.
What is up?
How's it going?
Pretty good, man. Looking forward to this. This is a great, you know, entrance into the horror month, so I'm looking forward to the conversation today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're excited to have you on a panel. And also roasting this week, filmmaker and political activist, you can find him on social media at True Cody Olson. Cody Olson.
Hello,
how's it going?
Going good. I'm feeling pretty productive today, which I always take as a minor victory in the midst of quarantine. So I was just like getting some stuff done, cleaning my apartment, making some calls for the Democrats. So feeling pretty good. I'm gonna talk about this movie.
Sweet. Well, yeah, it's great to have you here. And on the defense this week, teacher, writer, and Godzilla expert. You can find him on Instagram at PossessIan. Ian Coleman.
Hey.
Hey there. How you doing?
Pretty good. I guess I'm just kind of braving the, you know, my own little horror story of trying to teach school remotely. Oh, you know, man. It's going pretty good in a lot of ways, but, you know, there's the, you know, technological horror aspect of it. You know, there's getting Zoom bombed. There's, you know, lagging in the middle of a lecture and having to repeat yourself over and over. And yeah, I had to deal with a lot of that today. And it's left me kind of drained. So I'm glad to be.
Well, we'll rejuvenate you.
Yes, please.
Here tonight on the show, and we'll start by maybe draining you a little more with movie in a minute, as always.
All right, but
give us the full plot synopsis of It Follows, spoilers and all, and we'll give you 60 seconds and a three count. Are you ready?
Yep.
Okay. Well, let's do this thing. Here we go. In 3, 2, 1, go.
All right, so the movie is about Jay. She's a 19-20-something living in some, you know, beat-up town somewhere. And so she's going on a date with this hot guy, Hugh. And, you know, they have sex in his car, and then he chloroforms her and is like, oh, hey, by the way, I actually passed down an STD curse to you, and you're going to get chased by this strange entity who will, you know, lumber toward you with a bunch of creepy faces and maybe urinating itself. And if you want to survive this, you got to pass it down to someone too. So she, you know, tries to convince her friends that this is happening. They sort of, you know, realize that it is. You know, they try to track down Hugh, who turns out to actually be this guy named Jeff, and figure out more. He's like, nope, sorry, no can do. You just got to pass it on to someone else. So they, you know, try and run away from it. That doesn't work. They try to trap it in a pool that they want to electrocute, but that doesn't work either. So basically, you know, they all just kind
of... And you're out of time.
I always, like, get to the very last scene, and then time runs out.
It's almost like it's a perfectly engineered game.
Yeah, it's almost like it's rigged.
Nope. But yeah, so they get it into a pool. They get a couple headshots in there. And so her and she got this friend Paul hanging around all the time too. So they end up doing the dirty. And then kind of at the end here, they're dating and they're just, you know, walking down the sidewalk holding hands. We see over their shoulder somebody following them. And then the movie cuts the credits. And that's the end of the movie. but yeah, that's It Follows, everybody. And I love that you call him Hot Guy Hugh.
He is a hot guy.
I mean, he's just a guy. But anyways, he's Hot Guy Hugh now. And so, yeah, everybody, there's not much else to say before we take a quick break. And when we come back, Ian, we'll get your opening statements while you're here defending It Follows to kick off our horror month. Everybody, we will be right back. And we're back. Everybody, welcome back to our It Follows episode. We're here kicking off horror month with a nice 2010s film. A film. Before the what the before yeah.
How we doing?
Are my words my words aren't following, I'll tell you that much. Before the break, Ian followed the buzzer on Movie in a Minute. And almost got to the end of It Follows. But now Ian, let's get your opening statements why you're here defending It Follows.
Yeah, so It Follows is probably my favorite kind of horror movie. It's a movie that relies pretty much like, you know, it's very bare bones in the way that it like revolves a lot around like atmosphere and just really like seeping you. It steeps you in a feeling, like in that feeling, of course, being like, you know, the existential dread of, you know, ever present death. There's just also the kind of like aimless drifting of, you know, like kind of living in a shitty small town with like not much going on. You know, there's just that feeling of being lost, and it really just like, again, it like steeps you in that feeling and like right from the beginning, and it just never lets go. It's the kind of movie where, you know, you never feel safe. You know, frame of the movie potentially has something dangerous in it. Every moment is just like ripe with tension, and it's all really just like you know, it's all achieved very simply just through, you know, really solid filmmaking and camera work and a very simple concept that's just executed really well. Like all it takes is just have people walk toward you with blank faces and like maybe peeing yourself. And that's really all this movie needs. And it's great.
That's all it takes. Okay. Well, let's start with the roasters. Let's jump into, you know, there's rules to this world, and I think that's where we got to start.
Quasi, definitely. And I just have like one question about it. What the fuck are they? Because holy shit, the entire time I'm watching this movie, I'm so frustrated that I can't follow, Can't follow what the hell the rules are. Because it's some one thing to take a very simple horror concept. I applaud that, to try and execute that. But I also take issue with that executed really well comment, because it doesn't make any sense. The entire time, if they feel like the monster's only there to execute the plan of the plot. It's the things that they say about it don't always come true. They break the mythology all the time. And you're sitting there, yes, there's these tense moments, but they're kind of lies in a way, because it's not behaving in the way that it said it was going to behave, and it also doesn't make any sense when you see things that are happening on screen that they just said wouldn't happen or would happen. It's so frustrating to watch the entire time, knowing that this monster is just this thing that they set a mythology for. It was breaking it every step of the way.
Cody.
Yeah, I agree with Kwesi's larger point, and I just maybe want to drill down on one specific example that popped into my head, which is whether or not the characters can harm the It Follows creature. Because to me, I feel like there are two contradictory examples in the film. One, earlier on in the film when they're at the beach house, somebody shoots the It Follows creature, I think, in the neck. And it seems to go away. Or no, sorry, it does not go away after that. It just changes forms and keeps coming at them and trying to get through the door. So it seems like shooting them or harming them in any way that we would understand in the physical world doesn't really affect them. But then fast forward to later in the film when they're doing their plan in the swimming pool, and they finally kind of end that ruckus by shooting this thing in its head. And so I guess I'm just confused on specifically on whether or not they have any means to protect themselves from this thing, or if it's an unrelenting entity that you can't hope to harm.
Mm-hmm. Ian, go ahead.
I mean, I think the rules are pretty simple. Like, you have sex with someone who carries the curse or whatever. The thing is chasing you by walking.
But what is sex, though, Ian?
What?
Is it oral sex only? What if you wear a condom? Do you have to finish? Like, what are the rules?
It doesn't matter. Like, I feel like that's just a different movie. Like, this is not like a scientific explanation of like how the curse doesn't work. And in fact, I feel like, you know, like it's a really delicate balance to strike. Like, you don't want to make things so vague that you don't understand the stakes, but you also don't want to drag the movie in so much exposition that like you lose momentum. And I think this movie does a really good job of balancing that. It's like you get these rules that are simple. Like, this thing is following you all the time. You can, you know, delay it by either running away or like harming it. But like, I think just the overall overarching concept is that like you can, you know, you can delay it, but you can't ever stop it. Like, you can pass it on to somebody else, but it will probably come back for you. Like, I think it's all kind of existing in this very like abstract metaphorical space. And I feel like that, you know, the terror of it would be diminished the more that you understood about it. Like, you know, hey, if we wear a condom, it doesn't work. Oh, hey, like it will stop for, you know, 0.5 seconds if we shoot it in the head, but it will only stop for, you know, 0.3 if you shoot it in the leg. Like, that's not necessary. That would detract from the feeling that the movie is trying to immerse you in, which is, you know, dread and the existential horror of death always being at your shoulder and you can never avoid it.
Mm-hmm. I feel like, though, that there's some points to that that do need to be, you know, kind of focused in this movie, because yes, you can outrun it, but it also changes it doesn't change form consistently, and it also doesn't act as consistent as they say it does. Sometimes it stops, sometimes it just stands and just watches, sometimes it is acting extremely slowly. It's just wanting to add. It's not just a consistent thing. It's literally just if it was saying it was a ghost or some like other paranormal thing, that would make a little bit more sense. But it's just, if they're saying, oh, it's gonna follow you and that's it, and then it just stands there, or it's standing as a naked guy on a roof, or it's walking extremely slowly and peeing itself on the kitchen floor. It's just kind of like, oh, you're just. Okay, you're just trying to make like a little bit of a spectacle. You're not, you know, following any specific rule here.
Mm-hmm. Cody?
Yeah, I was just thinking about the guy on the roof, Kwesi, as you were saying that, because I think that is one of the more specific examples of this thing kind of breaking its own rules, where for the most part in the film, it's coming towards you at a kind of a slowly but persistently. But then sometimes you have a guy standing naked on the roof of the house, which just begs all sort of questions of how long had they been up there? They weren't in motion. You know, we didn't catch them going like, oh, I was about to come in the window. It, like you said, it seems like this spectacle that it, to me, makes other scenes confusing, because it sort of seems to be like this 10% breaking the relatively solid 90% rest of it, if that makes sense.
Ian.
I mean, you got to keep a couple of things in mind. First, like, no one knows where this thing came from and like what it's thinking. Anything that anybody knows about it is like, you know, secondhand knowledge. It's like, somebody told this to me, and like that's all they know. Like, nobody knows precisely what this thing is or like how it works. It's all just like things that have been passed down, and who knows what might have been lost, you know, in that chain. Two, I think it makes it like a lot scarier that you don't quite are. You're never quite able to read what it's thinking or like what, if any, intelligence that it's operating under. I think that's what makes like the most like terrifying movie ghosts, like, you know, Sadako from The Ring, Kayako from The Grudge, all those like really scary things, is like there's this combination of like being recognizably human but also like possessing some kind of alien intelligence that you can never quite get like a read on. And I think that it would diminish that significantly if we were able to, you know, understand how this thing is behaving and why it's doing what it's doing. Then it becomes like just, you know, a predator instead of this, you know, bigger, more abstract, ethereal, ghostly threat.
Yeah, I think let's move on a little bit. I know one thing we were talking about was, Kwesi, you said you were bored. So maybe let's talk about the pacing of the movie a little bit.
Yeah, I think that what Ian's talking about also relates to that, because it's using this the patience of the monster and these and kind of the underlying tension of waiting for it to come for the characters as a mechanism for these really long establishing shots that are also somehow just also a vehicle for the not really relatable and kind of out of place synth music that just shows up out of nowhere sometimes. There's not a lot of consistency in terms of how the shots work in the movie. And you get a lot of moments you're just sitting there like, we're just waiting with them, I guess, right? There's no reason for the plot to really move along right now. We're just watching a very beautiful shot of the pool. Okay. And they're sitting around the pool. All right. And we're waiting. Okay. And then the monster comes and it almost feels like, okay, finally let's watch something rather than a scary moment.
Mm-hmm. Cody?
Yeah, I agree, Kwesi. I think at times the film can feel sort of effective and deliberately slow-paced, and in those I love it. But there are other times where it just feels boring in a way, like slow-paced to the point of detriment. And I think one for me is there are sometimes the transitions can be a little weird, and one that I really bumped on this rewatch is when they track down hot guy Hugh, and the
his name is Jeff.
Oh, I thought Ian said hot guy Hugh.
It's hot guy Hugh.
That's how she perceives him, but he's really like jerk face Jeff.
Oh, jerk face, shit. Right, there it is.
There it is.
So once they track down jerk face Jeff, the mom says, oh, do you want to come inside? And they do. And the sort of energy of the scene to me seems to be building because we finally found this person. We're going to go confront him. But instead, all the energy is sapped out of the scene as we have this really slow crossfade to them pretty casually sitting in the grass talking with him. And for me, I feel like it's a weird, it just communicates this film sometimes doesn't know how to transition from scene to scene. Because I think specifically a crossfade is, it should be a little bit like life is going on. There's not a whole ton of change that should be happening in the middle of a crossfade. But like there's an entire confrontation when he first saw them enter his house that I think could have been a significant beat. And it just seems weird to be like, oh, they're chilling on the grass, you know? So I think that's just a larger example of kind of what Kwesi was talking about.
Ian, yeah.
I mean, for that specific scene, you got to keep in mind, like, you know, okay, like if they're going to like skip over something, like, you know, what could potentially be the significance of like this scene? And like, really all it would be is just kind of like, I mean, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it were like written and shot, but I'm sure that, I mean, it would have like, at this point, like we have that momentum of like everybody believes her at this point about the creature. Like there's a lot of, you know, like there's a really strong drive for them to like figure this out. And so they go to him and it's like, what's going to be in that scene that's cut out? Well, probably like some dead air, maybe like an awkward, you know, an awkward confrontation of like, oh, hey, you found me. How'd you do that? Hey, you infected me with this thing. Oops. Well, this, okay. Let's go outside and let's talk about that. Like, I mean, it's going to detract from that momentum of like, okay, we got to figure this thing out. How do we defeat it? I don't know. Let's go talk to Jeff. And then, you know, we cut to Jeff on the front lawn and we're still kind of like continuing with that train of thought. What's this thing? How do we beat it? How do we get away? Jeff goes, I don't know. And it keeps up the momentum of that.
But if you're missing these moments where you could catch a different type of attitude to the characters, because it feels like Jay's reaction is very subdued. And I suppose if you look at it through the lens of what Kwesi was talking about as a metaphor for sexual assault, then that could really be be how it played out. But this man lied about who he was. He courted you. He made you love him. And then you had sex with him. And then he passed thing on to you and disappeared. I feel like there would be a lot more motion in that scene rather than just picking grass and putting it on your leg. You know what I mean? I feel like if you're going to have these moments, yes, you could just cut to the crux of it, but you also have to give it something because then it's still a boring scene.
Cody?
Yeah, I agree, Kwesi. I think you said exactly what I was thinking in that they have been looking for this guy for a while, and there's kind of a lot of built up emotion and resentment that they have towards him. And instead of kind of some cathartic moment where we finally get to see him after searching for him for the whole first act, it's this really slow meandering fade, and I maybe beat a dead horse, but then it's this calm scene in the grass, and it feels like we skipped over, like you said, emotions, like salient emotions that Jay would have been having, that any normal person would have been having, but instead we kind of see them almost, it sort of feels like several minutes later and the tension has been diffused a bit. And I guess I'm just like, films about conflict, I don't understand why we didn't get that moment.
And if not,
diffuse the tension, you know?
So. Yeah, and if not from Jay, then from her team. Because I will say, she has a good squad around her. I think that the friends in this movie are great. I feel like that in some of these horror movies, you have really dumb friends. Everyone, a lot of her or her immediate circle are ride or die, which I really appreciated. But they don't have any emotion for this guy who did this to Jay. There's no emotion around it. Man, I don't know. It felt like a letdown a little bit during that moment, at least.
I mean, it's also like, you know, what's that really going to do to take your anger out on him? And you could even argue that, like, the picking on the grass and, like, putting it on her leg is her, like, you know, like, I mean, we never really perceive Jay as an aggressive person. Like, she, if anything, how I read that scene is that she's, like, sort of taking this, you know, kind of pent up fear, resentment that she's feeling, and like she's taking it out on the grass. Like for whatever reason,
refresh,
like, isn't
Ian,
able
refresh
to
your page.
And she's taking it out on the grass.
Hey, Ian, Ian.
What?
Ian, will you start that point over? Because you dropped out.
Okay. So I guess how I read that scene is that she is kind of taking that, you know, displaced, or that anger, that resentment, that sort of terror, and like she's taking it out on the grass at that moment. Like she's trying to, in that act, like dissociate from herself, from like the full terror of like what she feels. And it's a lot to confront. Like, you know, here's the guy who, you know, kind of like metaphorically sexually assaulted you. Here's the guy who passed a death curse onto you. You know, he's right there in front of you in the grass. Like, you know, he's just told you that there is no way to escape or avoid your fate. Like, I think she's trying to dissociate herself at that moment.
Casey had a hand up.
Yeah, I think that I read that scene in the way that she was like meticulously lining up the grass on her leg as a metaphor for self-harm. And like, maybe I'm reading way too much into this movie, but I think that that would actually be a realistic reaction to the situation at hand. And I think that something I find interesting about this movie, and I'd love to hear everyone's take on it, is that these are just like children, basically. Like, she seems like she might be 19 or 20, but like they're young, you know, and you don't really see an adult like ever in this movie except for the opening sequence. And so I think a lot of the reactions are kind of immature and childish. And does that like ring true? And if so, does that work?
I feel like childish could work but I also know that because they're young, dealing with it wouldn't necessarily result, maybe I'm reading too into it too, but it wouldn't result in reduced. It would enhance their anger or their passion for what's happening because they're scared and no one really understands it but them, and they need to deal with it themselves. I feel like that would amplify their emotions rather than subdue them.
Cody, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying that, Casey, I agree with your point that the grass picking seemed like a metaphor for self-harm. I feel like it evoked that in a visual sense for me. So I was thinking that, or something along the lines of her disassociating in that moment. So yeah, and then I was just, I guess your question was, they seem a little young, and did that work? And I think for the most part, kind of like Kwesi said, their crew is strong. And when the film is kind of exploring the bonds that these characters have, and them sort of having to do this on their own without the parents, I actually thought that was usually a pretty strong angle for the film.
Yeah, Cody and I applauded that bad boy of the neighborhood who just dropped all his shit to join them on this random mission. He just like, oh, I'm done. I'm drive you wherever you need to go. Let's go. Let's do this. I was like, okay, that's a solid team.
Yeah, respect to that guy.
Who's that? Greg. Let's see. So, I don't know. Ian, did you have anything to add about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the childishness stuff that you guys have been talking about really resonates. I mean, I think that the way that I interpret this movie is that it's like, it's young people confronting the, like, you know, horrible, like, gross reality of adulthood. And like, we sort of see that being exemplified in like the shapes the monster takes. It's like, you know, we've got like at various points, like people trying to look sexy. And then like, here's this sex monster, which is like often, you know, coming out with like its shirt down and like breasts poking out and urinating. Like, it's just all of like the grossness of the adult body laid bare. And I think that that angle like really resonates with me. Like, it's not just about death. Like, it's about like the, you know, inevitability of like what awaits us all. Like, we're all going to become gross. We're all going to get depressed. Well, not all. Okay. That's a blanket statement. We're not all going to get depressed, but it's a, you know, very true possibility, especially when you live in a shithole town. And I think that it just like, the film just works on so many layers, but like the premise is so simple that it's just like really like admirable to me.
Don't get me started on the shithole town. Where is
there? We
the
go
shithole
setting
town?
Let's go setting. Yes,
what, where are they? They have sex in a brutalist abandoned mall next to a lake and in a suburbia. Where in America is that? And then one of the girls also says that my mom told me never to come down 8 Mile. Are they in Detroit? What's going on? Like, I don't understand. And is it in the future? Is it in the 80s? The music seems to suggest the 80s, but their clothing doesn't say that. The technology doesn't say that. Infuriating.
Ian, what do you think?
I mean, I don't think that the specifics of where this movie takes place really matters. And I think that that's very purposeful on the filmmaker's part. I think, you know, in like taking away the specificity of time and place, it becomes like, I mean, it's a story about the universal experiences of like aging and death. And so you got to put it in like a universal context, which is, you know, like removed from any concrete sense of time and place. Like, this is a movie about the, you know, abstract experience of being like adrift and confronting aging and death in like, you know, a, you know, shitty decaying environment. It's not about, you know, the struggles of living in, you know, like, you know, poop hole Nevada. Like, it's, I think that
love it. Love poop hole Nevada.
It's on purpose.
But Ian, wouldn't the use of the technology of your day help you solve the problem of the monster? Couldn't that be a way that they, I feel like kids nowadays are a little bit more well equipped to handle something like that than kids would have been in the 80s. I don't know if they're already in a situation where they have this use access to this technology. It may have been a part of their way to maybe TikTok the homeboy while he was trying to kill you. And then all of a sudden now you have a following. You can figure out, you can, you know, use that to solve the problem. I feel like the technology of your age also would help inform how you dealt with the problem. So the setting does matter in that context. And if you're going to choose a setting, it has to be consistent with what you're trying, peril you're setting your characters in.
Well, I mean, I think giving them a tool to like defeat the monster would run like, or like, you know, setting it in a place where it would be easier to defeat the monster would run counter to the point of the film, which is that like, it's a monster that can't be defeated. Like, it's something that can never be escaped. You can push it away, but you can't get away.
Cody?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think Ian Kwesi's point wasn't that he wants to equip them with every tool possible. I think Kwesi just wants to know what playing field are they operating within. So is it the 80s? Okay, great. They have cars, they have a lot of modern conveniences, but they don't have things like cell phones. And so like that scene where she sees the creature coming into Greg's house would maybe make more sense if we kind of explicitly knew it was the 80s, because, all right, she tries to call him on like a landline, but that's a little bit less helpful. But then if we knew it was in modern days, then they would maybe have other tools and we would get to at least, you know, see how they try to use those and maybe they don't work. So I think it's just that Quasi's less like, we want the monster to be able to kick their ass, or we want them to be able to kick the monster's ass. I think Quasi just wants to know what tools are in their toolbox, and because it was a little vague, it's tough for us to know that.
I do want to know that, Ian. He is right. I do want to know that.
Okay. And I really don't think it matters. Like, it's an abstract movie about like confronting an abstract concept. I would go so far as to say that like this movie does not take place in our reality. Like, it's a movie world. It is a, you know, self-contained world created and it exists within the bubble of the film itself. And like, it is a film about an idea. And I think like the more specifics that you, you know, can put into the setting, like, I think the more you're going to have to drag it down. Okay. So if it's like, if we do have smartphones, we have to deal with that. If it's the 80s, we have to, you know, incorporate like all of these little bits of reality in there that could potentially drag it down. And it's like the film wants to be unencumbered by the, you know, like specifics of things that don't really add to it and just kind of like take up space.
I suppose so. But I think that in the end of the day, I feel that if it makes it a little bit more realistic, or if you're saying it doesn't take in our place in our reality, then yes, that means that anything kind of goes. But if you're looking to identify a little bit and see that your characters make the decisions that would make sense, that makes it a little bit more engaging. I feel like I'm also a little tired of them, like the same type of tropes of the characters making silly mistakes just to make a scary moment happen, or like they leave each other alone in these really stupid ways. Or when she crawled to the pool on her hands and knees, why are you making it so easy for this boy to come pull you into the water? I don't understand. So I feel like it helps when the characters can make smart decisions based off of the world that they're in. And if you don't know the world, then you don't know what those smart decisions could be, which I think is where I get a little frustrated. But if, again, yeah, if it's in a different reality, then, you know, yeah, man, anything can go.
Yeah, same. Because if we're misunderstanding it and it is modern day, then we would have maybe different, maybe more critiques of why are you not trying to videotape this thing on your cell phone? Then you could maybe show it to a parent and, you know, I don't know, that might help in some way. And again, so if we knew that it was the 80s, we'd go, great, they don't have that tool in their toolbox. Now we can go along with them on this journey and understand why they're not trying to videotape it as easily, for example.
Yeah. Ian, final response. We're going to unmask after this.
Okay. I mean, I think that they do make they very like generically make the smartest possible choices. Like this, you know, she notices that a thing is following her. Okay, she calls the cops. They can't do anything. You know, that'd be like pretty much anybody's first instinct. They learn the rules a little bit. They understand kind of the workarounds. Okay, they try to run away, and that doesn't work either. She tries the logical decision of passing on the curse, and that works temporarily, but it's a temporary solution. Like, I think that, like, even if the, you know, it's not as specific as, like, I'm going to try to videotape it, or I'm going to, you know, like, get on a boat to, you know, I'm going to go fly to Tokyo where this thing, you know, can't walk over the water. Like, as long as we're not getting in those specific level of detail in regards to like how they're trying to get away from this thing. But I think that in a general sense, they do make credible, smart choices. And again, the point of it all is that they don't work.
Mm-hmm.
It will always follow.
It will always follow. Well, everybody, we reached time to unmask. Let's go around. We'll talk about how we really feel. Ian, you may go first.
Yeah, I love this movie. I think it's a, you know, it's definitely one of the best horror movies of the 2010s decade. I don't know if I would go so far as to put it at the number one slot, but I would say it's definitely within that top 10. I think that it just really does. It really hits all the right notes of a horror movie for me. Like, you know, not a lot of gore, pure atmosphere, a creature that is alien and scary, a, you know, sense of dread that never lets up, a great musical score, like likable enough characters, you know, plot who make plausible enough actions. I think it's great.
Nice. Kwesi.
Yeah, what a great movie. I love this movie. I think everything I said is true in a way, but I think that the world building of it makes it better for rewatching, because you think more about what the situation is like for this girl, for Jay and for her team. And I think that knowing about the context, because for me, it also, at the beginning, I was like, oh, this is just a well-produced STD commercial about celibacy. But it is... having that thought about sexual assault gives it a whole different context for me, and I would love to rewatch it with that to see what else I could pick up on. It's visually beautiful. It's stretched out at times, but I love all of the visuals, and the characters are great. I had a great time. I love this movie.
Nice. Cody.
Yeah, I love this movie too. It's such an effective horror movie that Kwesi and I had to virtually watch it together.
Yeah,
I was released because I'm quarantined alone, and I'm like, oh man. But yeah, I mean, it's like Ian said, the atmosphere is so strong. The premise is simple yet well executed. I do think that those issues we brought up are things that I do believe are minor weaknesses in the mythology, but those don't really drag the film down very much. And what we didn't bring up is, frankly, the film answers a lot of other questions that I really didn't think it would when I was first watching it, just about the logistics of the world and like how people who can't see the thing interact with it. You know, it's like her friends can't see it, but they can see her hair being lifted up. You know, when it's attacking her, they can't see it, but they can throw a thing over it and then see the shape of it. So it's like a tangible thing out there in the world. So I think it's a super effective horror film and actually has pretty strong mythology behind it.
Nice. Casey.
Surprise. I also love this movie. I do think that I have to be in the right frame of mind for it. Because it's horrifying and scary, which is something that I think a lot of horror movies are either one or the other. I think that the tall man in the doorway is one of the most effective jump scares of all time.
Yo! Yeah!
I think, and to kind of expand on what Kwesi and Cody were saying, multiple watchings of this movie do give you more context. Like, the first time I watched it, I was kind of watching through laced fingers because that opening sequence is so scary that it just, like, kind of set me in the wrong mood to, like, fully pay attention to it. And the first time I watched it, I didn't even get that the entity that attacks her in the pool is taking the form of her dead dad. Like, holy shit. So there's a lot more layers to the terror when you give it a rewatch.
Yeah. I also love this movie. I remember the first time I saw it, and it was just like, I was like, well, suspense genre's over. What's next? Because I mean, I think this one is just like, hey, it's from the jump. It's just like, it's coming to get you. If you have sex, it'll still kill that person. It'll come and get you again.
Yeah. That first death is pretty serious.
Oh yeah. With her leg all snapped in half. But yeah, I think I've enjoyed it every time I've watched it. It gets under my skin every time. Like, it's just so chewy in its details. And I mean, and I know we were talking about, you know, the setting, the time, place, whatever. I love that it is not specific. It feels like it could be now. And so, yeah, it's wild. I love this movie. I love it so much. I put in a 24-hour horror marathon last year. But yeah, everybody, that's gonna do it for our It Follows episode. And we're gonna keep talking some more on Extended Play, which is our post show that's just for our Patreon folks. So if you want to listen to that, or a drink along, or a hot take, or anything else that is also up there, head over to patreon.com/24flamespod. You can get access to all that stuff, help support the show as well. Yeah, it's a bunch of goodies for pretty low prices. And If you got thoughts about it, it follows. You can email us at 24flamespod@gmail.com. You can find us on social media at 24flamespod. Wherever you get your podcasts, go leave a rating, review, subscribe. Help us help you enjoy the show more because that feedback is good and helps more people find the show too. But yeah, everybody. We'll be back next week as Horror Month continues, the Train to Busan. And the only way to keep up to date with all that stuff is subscribing to the show. This episode of 24 Flames Per Second was produced and hosted by me, Robert Spiewak, co-hosted by Casey Rom. The panels this week on the roasting side was Cody Olson and Quasi Phillips, and the defense was Ian Coleman. Our show music is performed, composed, and produced. There, I get them out of order every time. By Rob Joins and Will Paulson. And our networking co-op, Partyfish Media, is produced by Quasi Phillips, Will Paulson, and me. But yeah, as I mentioned, everybody, we got three more weeks of horror ahead of us, and it's gonna be a great time. Next week with Train to Busan, and on and after that. And so we hope you stick around and listen to those, and we'll catch you then, everybody. We'll talk to you later. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye
bye. Bye. Bye.
Party Fish Media acknowledges that it operates and records on indigenous Duwamish and Puget Sound Coast Salish land that is still home to the Duwamish tribe. This land is stolen in violation of the Point Elliott Treaty of 1855. We are committed to uplifting the name of these lands and community members from these nations who reside alongside us. For more information on this land, its people, or ways you can help, visit duwamishtribe.org or realrentduwamish.org.